Today's Teisho is on case 62 in the Heikigan Roku. Case 62 is entitled Umon's One Treasure. Engo's introduction. With untaught wisdom, he engages in the subtle action of inaction. With unsolicited compassion, he becomes your true friend. With a single word, he kills you and saves you. In one move, he lets you go and holds fast. Tell me, who is it that comes in this way? See the following. Main subject. Umon said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. It is hidden in the mountain form. You take the lantern, entering the Buddha hall, and take the temple gate, placing it above the lantern. Secho's verse. Look, on the ancient bank, who is that holding the fishing rod? Quietly moving clouds, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white flowers of the reeds, you see by yourself. This is a beautiful spring day. Beautiful. Last night, the moon was out, and there was a huge ring around the moon. It was quite dramatic. I'm sure some of you saw it. Melanie pointed it out to me, and I went out, and I was thrilled. So beautiful. And this morning, while we were making breakfast, I looked outside, and I saw a bluebird, which is a symbol of spring in the northeast. And also, just a very beautiful little bird. They're endangered now because of the Siberian starling, which was brought into the United States. There was a man who was well-intended, but he wanted to make sure that every bird mentioned by Shakespeare was in the United States. I know, it's amazing, right? So he brought in starlings because they are mentioned in Shakespeare. And the starling is a tough bird. It's from Siberia, and it's one of these birds that's almost indestructible. And he let it go here in the United States, and they've taken over. Sometimes you'll see in the fall your yard will be full of starlings. And one of the things they've done is push the bluebird out of the way, and so now people build bluebird houses. Bluebirds like to be on the edge of the forest, between the forest and the open space. That's their preferred habitat. And when there used to be a lot of farms in New Jersey, they did very well because they like to be at the edge of a field. Now this is a big problem. So seeing a bluebird was really thrilling. They're a small bird with a blue back and a red breast. And they're really very happy. You know, just looking at them can make you happy, you know. So spring is here. The flowers are not out yet, but all these signs of spring have begun. And this morning, when we were sitting, I could hear birds. You know, we don't hear those in the winter, and now the birds are back. And at my house, also in the morning when I sit, I hear, you know, the cacophony of bird sounds. It's really beautiful. So this is a beautiful sunny spring day. We're all here doing zazen together, and it's really wonderful, really quite magical. There's a lot of energy, I would say, in the room. People come into Dokusan and tell me interesting things about their practice, things that show they're really practicing wholeheartedly. Sometimes in Zen practice you are sitting on the cushion and not much is happening. And you can spend a long time in a kind of blank, empty state. If you're calling Mu, for example, you could spend a lot of time on the cushion just going Mu, 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 Mu. But if you keep working with the Mu koan, sooner or later, you come out of that dead blankness. It's a big mistake to think that emptiness or mu is about sitting in a kind of dead blankness, like a piece of wood, like a dead tree, right? You're just, there's nothing in your mind, you're dead, and so on and so on. That actually is called by Zen masters the practice of the dead, and it's not celebrated. It's thought of as either a transitional state or a mistake. You know, there probably have been people in the world of Buddhism who have thought of that state as a very good state, where there's just nothing going on. You're completely free from all distraction. You're completely free from all desire. And you're completely free from, or almost completely free from mental activity. And probably there are people in the world of Buddhism who have thought that was a highly desirable state. But that would be a huge mistake, really a huge mistake. To be in that condition is not a good thing at all. You know, sometimes we're in that condition on the cushion. You know, you're in on the cushion, you're watching your breath, you're blank, you're blank, you're blank, you're blank. And maybe you feel nothing at all. And that's as I say, that's a transitional state, transitional. At some point, if you're working on the Mu Koan, you might spend 3 or 4 years in that blankness. It could be a long time. I myself spent a number of years working on the Mu Koan, and it would just seem like every sesshin I would be sitting in that blankness. And I would just sort of be blank. And I would go into the Dokusan room and I wouldn't have anything to say. And that went on and on. But eventually, there's going to be this subconscious stirring of energy. It's like coming back to life from the dead, you know. And all of a sudden, there's this subconscious stirring of energy. And you perk up, you know, you feel better, and it could be quite dramatic. I mean, sometimes when you're working with the breath or you're working with Mu Koan, you can feel this surge of energy. Now, please don't try to make this happen. Please don't try to visualize energy, because that's very artificial. But when we enter Mu Xin, when we enter blank mind, and we stay there for a while, there can be this this surge of energy. It's quite remarkable, you know. And you can feel it. It's like all of a sudden it's like, you know, bzzz. And now you feel a kind of energy arising in you, you know. Maybe it feels like a pulsing or vibrating or, you know, it can be quite dramatic. You know, people talk, you know, sometimes people feel like there's electricity in their body or something like that. And of course, the calling Mu, when you go into the Dokusan room and call Mu, the teacher is really listening for the sound of that energy. So sometimes people are sitting on the cushion, they're blank, and they're in the blank darkness, and they still are immature in their Mu practice. As far as they're concerned, Mu is just this blankness, a sort of a dead emptiness. So they're sitting there going, moo, 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 moo. But as eventually what happens is your practice becomes deeper and matures, you begin to encounter this energy. And the idea of the Mu Koan is to take that, is to empty yourself out, let yourself become the vehicle for that energy. And so when you go into the Dokusan room and you open your mouth, you might be surprised at what comes out. You know, if you're trying to have a mighty move, if you're trying to give this great shout, you know, that probably will be very artificial. But if you're just blank, if you come into the Dokusan room with a blank mind and you open your mouth and you call Mu, sometimes what comes out can really surprise you. You know, it can surprise you. And you might think, where did that come from, you know, that great energy. But the arising of that energy is a sign that you are actually breaking down or that you have taken away the barrier between the unconscious and the conscious mind. And this is extremely important from the Zen standpoint. Extremely important. The unconscious and the conscious don't always match up. And this creates all kinds of problems. So something could be bothering you, right? And you might not want to deal with it. And so, you know, you could be walking around saying, everything's fine, everything's fine, everything's fine. And then, you know, maybe somebody cuts you off in traffic and you suddenly become explosively angry. You know, it's like, you bastard, you know. And on calmer reflection, you might think, well, why did I get angry this time? Or why did this make me angry? Because, you know, it's New Jersey. People cut me off all the time. You know, why this moment? You know, usually that means there's something under the surface, which is really the problem. It's not that somebody cut you off in traffic. There's something going on under the surface, there can be this unacknowledged tension or this unacknowledged unhappiness or, you know. So sometimes when we're working with the mu koan, you know, we're not able to open ourselves up to that energy because there's something else we have to deal with. You know, so it's hard to be spontaneous when you're keeping the lid on something inside yourself that you haven't dealt with. And one of the things that happens to people in Zen practice is that, you know, if you stay in mu long enough, the lid can come off, you know. So you might say, okay, I'm going to work on the mu koan. And you're going mu, 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 mu. And all of a sudden your mind keeps drifting back to something that happened 20 years ago. And you might think, what a distraction, you know. I've got to get back to my mu koan. But maybe there's something in those events that is important for you to recognize, you know, and work through. And working through means acknowledging and letting go. And when that process is over, you may find that it's much easier to be spontaneous in calling mu. At any rate, one day you're going to go into the Dokusan room and open your mouth, and what comes out is going to be this very unplanned natural energy and manifesting itself as sound. And my teacher Genki Roshi used to say, when I would go into the Dokusan room, I'd try to call mu, and it would just be so feeble. I would go in, you know, mu, mu. You know, or some people are very self-conscious. You know, you can hear them. They go moo. You know, other people will, you know, moo. But I would just go in and go moo, moo, moo. And Genki Roshi, on a couple occasions, he said, "Look, don't even show me your moo if you can't at least knock somebody over with it." You know. So then I tried to scream moo, and I made my vocal cords, I damaged my vocal cords. Really, I remember going into the Dokusan room and just, and it was like, about halfway through, my voice gave out. It was like I was going moo, and then it was like running out of gas, you know, moo, and I was really squeezing, and then my vocal cords gave out, and then I was like, moo, moo. Really, it was just like that. And I strained my, I guess singers can do that too. Years later, I had just given up all hope, and I went into, this was at our temple in the mountains. We had a beautiful place up in the mountains in eastern Oregon where you could see for 100 miles, and we built the zendo and a kitchen, and we had Dokusan in the kitchen. And I remember there were no windows in the kitchen at that time. It was summer. And I remember going in and sitting down in front of Genki Roshi and just opening my mouth. And it was like being possessed. It was like, how did that come out of me? You know, it was just this wave of energy. And I was astonished. You know, my mind was so blank, I didn't really think. But I opened my mouth and this thing came out, this like wind of energy, and I was just like, huh, you know. So that's a good thing. When that happens to somebody, it's the subconscious stirring of this energy, this life energy. And in Zen, this is very important. It's why, you know, it's possible to think about emptiness as this blankness, just blankness, this dead blankness. And in that state, people are, you know, completely, they have ideally no thoughts, no desires, no likes, no dislikes, nothing, right? And you might think that that's what Zen is all about. There are, as I say, there have been Buddhists who probably think that's it, at last free from all attachments, see. But the Zen view is that that's a very preliminary and immature state and not well integrated. It's really world denying. It's really not opening up to the unity of all things. So from the Zen standpoint, we access that energy, which is the energy of the universe itself, and we call Mu, even though that sounds so crazy to go into a room and scream Mu. What the teacher is looking for is the unrestrained expression of this natural, spontaneous energy. So this energy is like a very, very important aspect of life. Yesterday I was talking about the fact that, you know, there's a kind of misunderstanding of what Zen practice entails. And it might go something like this, you know. I should be happy with whatever I'm doing. I should be happy with whatever I'm doing. Now, there's a certain truth to that, right? So for example, people are assigned to wash dishes after the meals. Washing dishes is not a glamorous job, right? You have to get in there, you have to scrub the dishes, you have to move them along, and it's not as glamorous in a certain way. Maybe it's not as fun as cutting the vegetables, you know? I mean, everybody wants to be a chef, nobody wants to be a dishwasher, you know? And so cutting the vegetables is, you know, is creative, it's fun, you know? Being a dishwasher is unglamorous, it's thankless work, right? So, you know, there is a truth to saying, look, somebody's got to wash the dishes, and when you wash the dishes, you should do it 100%. You know, so wash those dishes. It's important. We all depend on you to make sure they're clean, that there's no soap on them, so we don't get diarrhea from the soap, and so on. So it's a very important job. Somebody's got to clean those dishes, and they've got to be rinsed properly. And so there's a Zen spirit that says, look, don't discriminate between cutting the vegetables and washing the dishes. Whether you're cutting the vegetables, whether you're washing the dishes, you should be there 100%. You should do it wholeheartedly. Now that's true. That's absolutely true. But there's another, it's a kind of a mistake to therefore think, I should be happy no matter what I'm doing. Or no matter where I am, this is complicated. But it's a mistake to For example, one of my favorite painters is Georgia O'Keeffe. I just love Georgia O'Keeffe's work. I love New Mexico, and she did a lot of painting in New Mexico. And her paintings are just really unlike anything else in the world of painting. You know, so. You know, I think I've talked about Georgia O'Keeffe before, but she taught art at the University of Virginia at one point in her career. She was an instructor in art classes. And she worked for a man who was the head of the art department. And Georgia O'Keeffe showed that man some of her drawings, and he laughed and said, look, you're a woman. You'll never be an artist. You'll never be taken seriously as an artist. And later he said, "Marry me." Right. So basically, he put her down and later proposed to her. Interesting dynamic. She didn't marry him, fortunately, and she didn't put down the art. She kept drawing, and she sent some drawings to a woman who was a friend of hers, whose brother was a famous art dealer and a photographer named Stieglitz, Alfred Stieglitz. And Stieglitz looked at these drawings, and without even telling Georgia O'Keeffe, he put them up in his gallery, which was the hottest gallery in New York at the time. And everybody came and looked at these drawings and said, "These are fantastic." You know. And then he wrote her and said, "By the way, you know, there was an article in the New York Times about your drawings today. I'd like to meet you." So Stieglitz and Georgia O'Keeffe met, and you know, actually, eventually they got married. But the thing was that Georgia O'Keeffe kept going with her art, and she didn't stop. And you know, she had many difficulties in her life. Stieglitz was not a good husband to her. He cheated on her quite a bit, and while he was cheating on her, she was doing a set of murals for, I think it was New York City, some big public space in New York City, and the mental and emotional strain really got to her. She kind of had a nervous breakdown, as a matter of fact, and she didn't paint for 2 years, but she came back and from her collapse, her mental collapse, and she did some of her greatest artwork. So, you know, Georgia O'Keeffe's an interesting story. Her life in art is really exemplary, I think, of somebody who has found their energy, right? You know, found her energy and had been true to her energy. And there were many things that were discouraging, you know, like her boss when she was a young art instructor. You know, some of the critics at first were a little bit dismissive of her because she was a woman, even though she was hugely talented. And eventually her own mentor and husband betrayed her, you know. But she kept going with this energy, and she kept producing these amazing paintings. You know, nobody ever thought of painting a New Mexico. She would take a picture. She would paint a picture of an antelope skull floating in the sky over the New Mexico desert. You know, and it's just hauntingly beautiful. Now, you know, it would have been a big mistake for somebody to say to Georgia O'Keeffe, "Look, Georgia, you know, you should be just as happy." Typing letters as you are painting pictures. You know, you should be just as happy typing letters or painting pictures. It's all the same. Now, you know, I've been thinking about this for about 35 years in my Zen practice. This has been like a koan for me. And I don't claim to have the definitive answer to the koan. But it seems to me that Georgia O'Keeffe should not have become a stenographer, you know, on the theory that you should be happy doing whatever you're doing. I think that if you have to type letters, you should be in the moment and type the letters well. You should try not to make any typing mistakes and so on and so on. But I think that her energy was clearly with painting these pictures, you know. And I think this is quite important, that Zen practice is not about, how shall we put it, self-annihilation. You know, we say, get beyond the small self. Get beyond the small self. And we even talk about sitting as dying on the cushion. But I don't think Zen is about self-annihilation. I think it's about having contact with the deeper self. You know, some things are not... Some things make you feel alive and some things don't. Now that doesn't mean you have to do the things that make you feel alive 100% of the day. You know, that's not always possible. my sister-in-law, Sydney, who's living with my wife, Barbara, and me, is a painter. And I have to say that she hasn't been, you know, commercially successful in her life. And she's quite a good artist, but she just hasn't been able to make a career of her art. So for a long time, she had to work in a halfway house. She has a background in psychology, and she worked in a house for children who have, mental disorders. And she would work at this place, and she would come home and do her painting in the evening. Now, that's her life. That was her life. And it wasn't as much fun as being able to paint all the time. It would be great. You know, I think Sydney would have liked a life where the galleries were on the phone asking for her paintings, and she would have had to, you know, quickly paint some paintings every day, or, you know, that would be wonderful, but it's just not how life worked out. So she had to go to a job where she worked 8 or 9 hours a day, and it was difficult work, but she still kept painting. And I think when she was on her job, she did the best she could. You know, she was intelligent and present, but it wasn't, it didn't give her the same energy as painting the pictures, you know. And I think it would have been a big mistake for Sydney to have said, well, you know, painting pictures or typing reports, it's all the same. I think there's a difference between something that that makes your mind bright and alive and something that doesn't. And I don't think that's a wrong discrimination. Ideally, you would have a bright mind no matter what you do, and that would be great. But I think it's important to pay attention to the things in life that make us feel alive. And I think that Zen practice is all about taking away the barriers to those things that make us feel alive. Sometimes we can't come alive at all. You know, that's often the case. You know, we're just maybe too frightened to come alive, or we're too self-conscious, or we have too many self-doubts, you know. But Zen can put us in touch with a kind of fundamental spontaneity. By taking away the barriers, Zen lets us discover our energy. And life, from the Zen standpoint, a skillfully lived life is a life that is able to access that energy in a way that's central to one's life. Is accessing that energy and feeding on that energy. Different people have different forms of energy, but I think when you're in that energy, you feel connected to things around you. You feel connected to things around you. Now, you know, you have to be, it doesn't mean, my wife's uncle, Paul, was quite a great artist, in my opinion. Some of his statues are here and there at various galleries, and he isn't like internationally famous, but he really was a good artist, and he did some really beautiful sculpture. He's a sculptor primarily. And I have to say, he was a terrible father, and he was a terrible husband to all four of his wives. He's one of these guys. Actually, I knew him. He died when he was quite young. He was like only in his 60s when he died. I stayed with him in New York when I was looking for an apartment in Highland Park. When I first got my job at Rutgers, while I was looking for apartments, I stayed in New York with Paul at his studio in Brooklyn. And I stayed with him, and he was the most charming, wonderful man. But basically, you know, he didn't pay attention to being a good father. And his kids had some serious problems, including one of his kids had a drug problem. And he went through many different wives, all of whom looked exactly the same, by the way. His first wife had dark, was tall and Italian looking and had dark hair. His second wife was tall, Italian looking and had dark hair. His third wife was Italian, okay, and had dark hair. Right? His fourth and last wife, Elise Bogovsky, was not Italian, but she had long dark hair. So he had a thing, I guess, for people with dark hair, but he wasn't probably a good spouse, you know. And so he needed to work on that aspect of his life. But he did find that energy in his painting and in his sculpture, primarily in his sculpture. And he worked on it beautifully. You know, he really was. It's a shame he couldn't have worked out the other aspects of his life. But he honored that energy in a way that I think was important. Maybe if he had, he could have found the energy in other things too. You know, there's different forms of energy. I, as you know, I like to do zazen. I get a lot of energy from doing zazen. However, one of the things my wife likes to do is gardening. I grew up on military bases and really didn't have an experience of gardening. But my wife's family always had gardens, and so over the years I've gotten into gardening. And I have to say that I find it very energizing to garden, you know. I actually enjoy digging holes and putting things in there that are, you know, plants or preparing the soil for tomatoes. And there's something very energizing about, you know, going out and looking at your tomatoes and watering them and taking care of the squash and things like that. And you look every day, they're a little bigger. It's very cool, really, you know. Last year, I have to say, the deer got into our behind our garage and ate everything. So I went out to look at our tomatoes and the deer had eaten them down to the stump. So that was a difficult moment. Maybe this year we'll do a better job of keeping out the deer. I learned, and another thing I learned is I like plants now. So I've really studied plants, which I never used to understand. I used to go into a forest and all the trees that were green, evergreens, I would just say those are pine trees. But now I know pine, spruce, I know different kinds of spruce. I know different kinds of pines. I'll say, that's a loblolly, that's a New Jersey white pine, that's a jack pine, you know, and most people aren't really interested in this, but it's actually quite interesting to me. So I've found a way to get, there's a kind of energy to gardening, which I've learned, you know, and I love it, you know. And there's other kinds of energy too. Last year at this time, during the session, I started talking about my friend Larry Sullivan. Larry Sullivan was a longtime friend of mine. It goes back to college, and we used to backpack together. And I said, at the session, I said, I'm going to give my friend Larry Sullivan a call, and I think I'm going to try to go backpacking with him. And because of my life, you know, and including, you know, Zen and everything else, I just haven't gotten out into the mountains, you know, for years and years. So I decided I'm going to go out and hike with Larry, and we went out to Wyoming, and I had an incredibly good time, and I just felt so energized, you know. So I think one way to understand the Zen life is this is not about learning to live with nothing. You know, we talk about nothingness and so on, but I don't think Zen is about, you know, I mean, there are people in the Zen world who have one robe you know, in the winter and one robe in the summer, and they sleep on a tatami mat, and they have no possessions and no money, and there's nothing wrong with that. Those people have many forms of energy. They love the simplicity of that life. They love the simplicity of that life. They're like Thoreau, you know, basically. They love that simplicity. People who live in monasteries have that kind of simplicity all the time. And it's, if hopefully, it's hugely energizing for them. So when they get up and do kinhin, or when they work in the gardens outside the temple, they might be cooking, you know, all of these things might be very energizing for them. And they really like the simplicity of it, you know. They really love the simplicity. It makes them feel alive when they're simple. Now, there are some people who would just find that deadening, right? And there are some people who, you know, like to live in a house. And it's very energizing for them to live in a house. And you could say, whoa, but the ideal is to live on a tatami and have nothing. But that works for that person, right? That person is in a quest for simplicity that makes that person feel alive. But another person in that circumstance might feel dead and very flat and empty. And so Zen is not about having nothing, being nothing, going nowhere, doing nothing, and learning how to be happy. I think that's a mistake. I think that Zen is about finding your energy and building on that, you know. And in Zen, what we do is we start with something very simple, just being one with the breath. And we find this energy is available to us, you know. And then we begin to create a life around this energy. And it's like it spreads through the rest of our life. My second teacher, Kangan Webb, was raised by a fundamentalist Christian family in Oklahoma. He was an adopted kid. And this family of fundamentalists wanted him to be a great concert pianist. Their dream was that they would produce a fundamentalist pianist who would be world famous and would spread their fundamentalist version of Christianity. They gave him a very excellent teacher of piano. And Glenn said his piano teacher used to make him play the piano with little glasses of water on top of the tops of his hands. So, the idea was to keep your hands totally straight and just move your fingers on the keys. And so she'd put little glasses of water there, and he'd have to go up and down without spilling the water. And this was to give him total control over his hands. Apparently, Glenn became a prodigy. He actually did become a really great pianist. And he gave concerts. Apparently, he had like a nervous breakdown. The pressure, he was under such pressure to be a brilliant pianist that he had some kind of emotional collapse. Years later, we were having a sesshin at this rented place where there was a piano in one of the main rooms. And at the end of the sesshin, Webb went in and he started playing the piano, and it was just extraordinary. It was so beautiful. And so his ability to play the piano was just extraordinary. But after his sort of collapse, he sort of moved in a different direction with his life, and he became very interested in art history. And basically, he went to Japan just to study some famous paintings. And he went to this monastery where the paintings were stored, and he had no interest really in Buddhism or Zen meditation, but the teacher there said, look, if you want to study these paintings, you're going to have to do Zazen. And so Webb started doing zazen, and he basically did a lot of zazen. He came after he had his Daikensho and was ordained and so on and so on. He came back to the United States to teach art and started the Seattle Zen Center. And after about 10 years, he discovered tea ceremony, the chado. And this is a ritual of preparing and serving tea. And this became his life. Every Sunday he would go to the tea house in Japan, he and his wife Carol, and they would do tea ceremony all day on Sunday. And then Webb went to Urasenkei, this great tea school in Japan, and he would study there every summer for months. And he's become one of the world's experts on tea ceremony, which is this very beautiful, slow ritual that has to be done like impeccably, you know. So he did tea ceremony at least once a week, all day, and he probably did it every day. And it was so clearly his energy. You know, he continued to teach Zen, but tea ceremony has been his life. It's his passion. And Carol, I don't think it was her passion at first, but she got very interested in tea ceremony, and she became a tea master in her own right, and she's very good with ikebana, or flower arrangement as well. Now, from the Zen standpoint, Webb's life has been a very good life, because he has experienced these multiple sources of energy, and he's used those to widen the circle of his life, make it broader and more inclusive. This is like a very healthy life. His experience with tea ceremony opened many other doors to him, to people, to places. I was just reading that a few years ago they had a tea ceremony in New Mexico. And it was the tea conference. They have like a annual get-together of tea people, and they had it in New Mexico. And he has people from all over the world who are involved in tea ceremony. The point is that, how does it put it in this koan? Let's see. Umon said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. Now, what is that one treasure? When we're in the energy, that experience of oneness becomes very powerful, very dramatic. And we feel connected with everything around us. When I'm doing zazen, sometimes I have, sometimes I sit on the cushion and I have problems. I'm thinking about things in my life, blah, 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 I'm worried, blah, blah, blah. And then I'm working with my breath, I'm entering deep mushin, and all of a sudden it's like something switches off and something else switches on, and I just feel so alive and so connected, and my problems seem very small, you know. That's the one treasure. My old teacher Glenn Webb gets that from tea ceremony. He sits down and he starts washing the bowls and preparing the, and all of a sudden he's there in that one treasure mind. Everything, it's like the whole universe is now alive and unified in this moment. Umon says it's hidden in the mountain form. It's hidden in the mountain form. In other words, things are not alive or dead in themselves, right? It has to come from in us, from within us. We have to find the things in life that harmonize with our big mind. One person takes music lessons and hates them. Another person takes music lessons and feels like her whole or his whole world is being opened up. See? And that means that for the person who hates music, inside and outside are not matching. But when we find things in life that make us feel alive and connected, we must hear that. It's very important to pay attention to that. You know, living life for that energy is quite crucial, really crucial. But it's hidden in the, you know, we have to look for it by paying attention to subconscious stirring, you know, subconscious stirring. If we begin to feel that energy on the cushion, we can expand that to other areas of our life off the cushion. And that's the exemplary life in Zen practice. So, you know, today we're doing our Zazen. Some of us are calling Mu, some of us are working with the breath, and some of us are just in a kind of blankness, you know, and just patiently waiting. We'll keep calling. But eventually there's this energy that will arise, and it's really quite wonderful. And then, you know, after the Mu koan, other koans are also looking at ways of getting access to that energy. You know, so when somebody gives you a koan, it's hard to penetrate because usually there's some, we're blocking that energy in some way. We're blocking it. So, you know, the koan might ask you, you know, what's the sound of one hand clapping? And that is really pointing to a way of being free and connected to the world, but we can't access it because we're blocked. So the koan is helping us to open a door in ourselves to let the energy flow freely. And then the next koan is another door opening experience, and then the next one. And as we go on and on with this process, more and more of ourselves is open and available to that beautiful life energy. Engo's introduction. With untaught wisdom, he engages in the subtle action of inaction. See, when you're doing something that is really alive, you don't feel that you're trying too much, right? It's just spontaneous. So, for example, sometimes you'll sit on the cushion, and you sit down on the cushion, and 20 minutes seems like an eternity. 25 minutes seems like an eternity, especially on day two of sesshin. But sometimes, if you're really in the flow, you sit down on the cushion, and half an hour goes like that. You know, this morning we did, yesterday morning and today we did 40-minute sits, and everybody was so still. And, it, you know, when you're really in the groove, it's just like the blink of an eye. So when the energy is flowing, it's the subtle action of inaction. With unsolicited compassion, he becomes your true friend. With a single word, he kills you and saves you. In one move, he lets you go and holds you fast. Tell me, who is it that comes this way? See, it's not about, there's no one right way. Each of us is different. Each of us has to access the energy in ourselves in a little different way. And it's not a matter of holding fast or letting go. Both of those can be dead or both of them can be alive, depending on the arising of this energy. Okay, main subject. Umon said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there's one treasure. It is hidden in the mountain form. You take the lantern entering the Buddha hall and take the temple gate, placing it above the lantern. This is all about how we experience the world in this unified mind. Secho's verse, look, on the ancient bank, who is that holding the fishing rod? Fishing rod. Quietly moving clouds, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white flowers of the reeds, you see by yourself. You know, nobody can see through your eyes except you. You know, nobody can tell you how to access the energy in yourself. You have to find that route yourself. This is why Zen practice is difficult, right? When you find it, everything becomes unified. Everything becomes alive. You know, even rice in your bowl. Everything becomes alive. So, this beautiful path that we're walking is even more wonderful than people might think. It's all about living life to the fullest, yeah, and having a biggest world. Ultimately, the idea would be everything becomes alive. Everything is energy. And that's the work of many bodhisattva lives. So, let's continue to practice.